Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Today we're here in New York, and our conversation is with the world's largest alternative asset manager, Blackstone. And specifically, we're going to talk with their global head of Blackstone's $190 billion private wealth solutions business. And to do that, we have Joan Solotar. Joan serves on the firm's management and operating committee, twice has been nominated for Barron's 100 Most Influential Women in Finance, highly ranked institutional all-star investor at Credit Suisse and DLJ. So Joan, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here. Love your show. So this is really a thrill for me.
Well, I'm excited about this conversation and to be here in Blackstone's offices in New York. So you are, I think, unusual on this show, not because you have 2 degrees, but you have your first in management information systems and your second from NYU, which is your MBA. And I just wondered how they have each helped and differently assisted you.
Yeah, it's a great question that no one has ever asked before. Management information systems today would be called computer science, programming, system design, but it was housed within the business school. So I had a mix of quantitative, analytical, and then formal business training. Probably most important is that I was hired my first job because the bank analyst at First Boston wanted someone who could program on a mainframe. Now, mind you, I showed up and realized I did not have enough accounting or finance training and pretty quickly started business school at night. So I would say most critically, it got me my first job.
So research, clearly very successful and well-ranked and respected. Whilst you were becoming a well-respected analyst, were you thinking, actually, the buy side, asset management is where I'm going to be drawn, or was it simply serendipity that took you to Blackstone?
It really was serendipity, but it also related to the fact that I covered financial services companies my entire time in equity research, anything from banks to credit cards to brokerage firms to asset managers. And it was those latter two sectors that I focused on mostly and where I obtained the ranking. That afforded me the great opportunity of taking a lot of companies public, including the likes of Goldman Sachs, for example. So when Blackstone filed to go public, they called and asked if I would come over and build out shareholder relations. So that really is how I wound my way here.
So let's talk about Blackstone, but let's start first at a higher level. I think that, and the numbers I have may even be out of date as of a few weeks ago, but you're closing in on $900 billion, so trillion is in sight. How do you think Blackstone has been able to establish such a huge imprint in the world of alternatives?
First and foremost, every business has been built off of the back of good performance. So institutional investors who had a good experience in private equity, in real estate, really got to know the management team, the rigor, and the investment process, were willing to then invest in scale in some of our new areas. But I would say most importantly, there is just a wonderful ecosystem here where when we think about creating a new business, it's through the lens of how will that business help our current businesses and how will our current business help that? And do we have some kind of sustainable advantage? Will this provide an excellent experience for the end investors? Do we have a team of 10 out of 10s, highest quality people? Do we ultimately think we have some kind of moat? So it's never around, well, we're not in that business, the so-called white space, so let's just attack it. It always starts with where we see a good investment opportunity and then whether we can build that into a leading scale business. And we've been able to do that over and over again.
And so did the private wealth solutions business come later? And at what point did you get parachuted in to take charge of it?
It's interesting. If I go back to 2008, we had just acquired our credit business. And through a lot of discussion around distribution, we recognized that, one, we were just starting the global financial crisis, and two, we were now going to the same set of investors, mostly U.S. pension funds, who are still important clients, and asking them to allocate what was now a diminished pool of assets to yet another fund. And so the discussion really catalyzed expansion outside of the U.S., Europe, and Asia, where previously we didn't do a lot of fundraising. And then thoughts around how can we build out something for private wealth. A few years later, we hired an individual to launch that business. And the focus was distributing through the largest U.S. firms. I became involved about 6 years ago when I was asked to build it out as a large global business. And at that point, we added multiple channels, multiple regions, and began designing products that were bespoke for retail.
So how would you explain the mission of Private Wealth Solutions?
Our mission is to bring institutional quality product to individuals, to educate advisors, and to match good performance with excellent service.
Now, I note reading some research, you have written that underlying all of this is a democratization of the alternatives. And just help me and help our listeners understand what you really mean by that.
So what I mean by that is if you look back 10 years or so, really the only individuals who were investing in the likes of private equity or private real estate or private credit were the very wealthy. And some of that is dictated by regulatory restrictions. But if you put that aside and assume we're not changing that, the other element is that they didn't have access to good product. We were not set up at that time to really serve advisors with everything I just mentioned, investor services, education, and the like. And so we sat back and thought, well, what can we do end to end to really start to serve that market? And so we built out PWS, which now stands at 225 employees around the world, to approach the market in a way that benefited them. And I want to add, I think this is very important. I think historically, and maybe even today, some asset managers will look at the market as just selling a product. But I always tell my team, like, we are not a sales organization. We are an end-to-end business serving the advisor. And I think when you approach it in that manner, you're partnering with firms, you're trying to figure out what they need. A lot of firms today have goals of a much higher penetration of alternatives in their portfolios. They see the value of it, but they really didn't have any way of accessing it at scale, and that's what we've been able to bring. So democratization, to me, just means providing more good product to more advisors who can then put it in their clients' portfolios.
So we're going to break down that alternatives silo in a second, but one question strikes me from our earlier conversation is, where do you think we are on this journey of adoption as a standard slice of the asset allocation for the investors you're addressing?
It's a great question. I think you have to break it down regionally. But in the US, which is perhaps the furthest along, the penetration rate is still minuscule, less than 5% from what we can tell in terms of numbers that are available. Then you go to Europe and you go to Asia and Latin America, and it's an even smaller percentage. So in the US, we use baseball terms. You can tell me the equivalent over there. So if you think of a baseball game's innings or anything that has 10, we're in number one. The first inning is how we would put it. So I would say it is still very early days.
Right. For those of us who love cricket.
Yeah, cricket games are longer than baseball games.
Well, they are. However, that long format is something that England has become rather abject at. So we're not going to take much time talking about that. I want to talk about this alternatives space. And although people immediately in conversations in Europe default to hedge funds, real estate is an area where Blackstone has an unquestionable footprint. And I wonder whether we could start by you just telling me about what it is that you have done to become such a force in that area.
Real estate is one of the investing businesses in which we have perhaps the widest moat, where during the financial crisis, we were able to distinguish ourselves by actually generating a positive performance for institutional investors at a time when most funds lost most of their client assets. We utilized the same investment team to create a product for individuals. So that's attractive. No adverse selection, if you will. And then demonstrated good performance over the last 5 years in that product. So that's the Blackstone piece of it. The other question is, why now? And in an environment of rising interest rates, potential for inflation, which we're seeing now, investors are seeking good yield with some upside. And that's what real estate can provide if you're in the right sectors. And what are the right sectors? The right sectors have some kind of structural shortage. So in terms of supply demand, areas like multifamily housing, where there just aren't enough houses being built to meet demand. Areas like logistics, where e-commerce continues to grow as a percentage of shoppers. That's happening everywhere in the world. And you can't just build a first mile warehouse anywhere you want. So there's also limited supply. These are themes that we've been investing in for many years, where we can do something in scale that others can't. So it's been really a virtuous cycle, if you will. So we had the Blackstone brand. We have an asset class that performs well in the current environment and also just fits nicely next to typical stocks and bonds.
So let's just stay with the real estate question, because for a lot of those very significant pools of capital, diversification is one of the goals, and that means extending beyond the domestic frontier. But you've got this matrix which involves different client groups sitting in different parts of the world with different appetites, and you've got the pursuit of opportunities beyond the boundaries. So when you are thinking about real estate in Asia, for example, and a client base there which is essentially Asian, how different is it from what a US investor might get?
So in essence, we are investing across the US, Europe, and Asia, and we have investors in all of those areas. And I would say the common thread among the investors is that they're all currently facing a similar market and economic backdrop of low rising interest rates and rising inflation. And so if that is what you're presented with, you're trying to figure out how to generate a real return, how to generate a yield that's higher than inflation.
So you rightly observed early on that standard allocations to long-dated fixed income might be injurious to your health. But you have built a very interesting credit business, and I'd like you to tell me about it, because at least reading the materials, I get the impression that you're disintermediating the banks. How has that happened?
Well, I would say going back to the global financial crisis, the regulations that were placed upon banks restricted what they could hold in terms of risk. And so banks went from lending and retaining risk to syndicating risk. So if you are a sponsor and you're buying a company, you'd like to know who the lender is, who has control, who owns the fulcrum security, rather than see it syndicated out where you have no idea who actually owns the debt of the company where you have the equity sitting underneath. So that really was the first catalyst. And then over time, we really built the credibility with sponsors, being able to work with complexity, to work in scale. And the final piece, which is Blackstone specific, is that we bring to bear our portfolio operations group, our group purchasing company, to those firms as well, so creating additional room for EBITDA growth. So if you think about, you're a sponsor, you're buying a company, and we're telling you, hey, we can improve EBITDA by 50 basis points, that actually gives you a little bit more room in terms of what you can pay on the debt side.
So staying with the alternatives, you've explained clearly the real estate proposition. I understand credit is growing strongly and in a yield-starved world has great attraction. That leaves the two other legs of the stool, which is private equity and hedge funds. Again, you're very well associated with private equity. We've had on the Money Maze podcast Sir Ronald Cohen talk about, you know, his whole approach to private equity. And we had Robert Smith of Vista Equity Partners talk about it very specific. But just explain to me high level, first of all, how you approach private equity.
So to date, we have offered our private equity funds, our growth equity funds, to qualified investors in the US or professional investors in Europe and similar in Asia. We have not offered to the broader accredited mass affluent, and that's really due to the regulatory restrictions. I do think there will be creative solutions similar to what we've seen in real estate, in private credit, that will make their way to private equity and similar.
And then the hedge fund piece, again, how have you approached it and how has it been changing, given that there's been a lot of what I would think perhaps is not fair criticism of returns in the hedge fund space, perhaps courtesy of the very strong markets we've had? How have you approached it and is it changing?
When you think about the hedge fund products that have been offered broadly, they're mostly structures like UCITS in Europe or daily liquidity here. And when you think about the advantage of private equity, of private credit, of private real estate, it's that you're able to benefit from the illiquidity. You can earn more if you're willing to hold something longer and not subject to the whims of daily liquidity. And I think that first generation of hedge funds offered to most individuals, whether it was UCITS structure or here daily liquidity format, really didn't offer much advantage versus mutual funds, if you will. I do think there's an ability to create products that might have slightly longer liquidity terms, where you could get some of the same benefits that you have in private real estate and in private credit. We don't have that product today, but I do think that has been somewhat of a mismatch and unfortunate for investors. You have to balance between liquidity, risk, and return. And if what you want is daily liquidity, it's probably not the best match for an alternative product.
So you've touched on the super important area. David Swensen, of course, wrote at Yale about the illiquidity premium. You've got a private wealth segment here, even if there's a large intermediary component in it. So there's an educational piece about liquidity. And I read that you have actually spent quite a lot of time, money, effort on building out an educational capability.
I think this is why I'm so excited about the opportunity for this business, because we are still in such early days of educating advisors. But we launched Blackstone University, which originally was in person only, but now in a Zoom world, you can do it in a hybrid manner and reach many more people. And during those sessions, we start with the basics, how alternatives fit into a portfolio. What is private equity? What is private credit? What is private real estate? These are not intended to be sales promotions. They really are foundational in terms of the education for advisors. We talk about the macro environment. And also importantly, we share the intellectual capital that we're garnering from our different portfolios, whether it's real estate or companies, so that the advisors are smarter and so that they understand how we're thinking about investing, and then they can articulate that to their clients. If you flash forward to March of 2020, when COVID first hit, we saw an explosion in demand for that kind of content. Advisors wanting to know what we were seeing on the ground, what we thought was happening. They wanted to be able to share with their clients what we saw in our own portfolios. And I think during that moment, when we were very transparent, when we were very accessible, it accelerated the relationship that we had with advisors. And so flash forward today, whereas we used to have maybe 150, 200 advisors in a Blackstone university, today in a virtual world, we'll have thousands.
So that brings us to maybe an interesting segue, which is that both you and Steve Schwarzman have articulated this important mantra, which is protecting capital is where you start. But we are perhaps at an intersection, both in terms of value and growth, in terms of inflation and rates, perhaps longer and rising volatility and a different investment epoch. We can educate, one can learn, but one gets tested. How are you responding to client anxieties?
It's a great question. We talked about private credit before, and I get the question frequently, aren't you worried about credit losses? I think in the current environment where we still see strong economies, we're more concerned with interest rate risk than we are credit risk. We don't see signs of recession. And as it relates to credit, your goal is to get the money back at the end of the day. So credit underwriting is so important. And as it relates to the other companies, I'd say the difference between public market investing and private investing is, one, you have an asymmetrical information advantage on the private side, where you're signing non-disclosure agreements, you're getting non-public information, you have 6 months to figure out how to improve the asset. But the second piece is that you control the entry point, you control the exit, and you control what happens in between. You can change out management, you can extend products, you can extend region. And about two-thirds of the value creation is what we're doing with that asset or with that company. So I think particularly environments like this, where you can't assume that a stock market will just continue to rise, you have to know, well, how are you going to create value? And that's typically when I think we're at a big advantage.
So let's talk about three things: culture, valuation, and size. And let's start with size. So you are approximately a quarter of the whole group's business, if I'm not mistaken in my numbers. Where do you think you'll be in 5 years?
I think I will be much bigger.
Otherwise, you may not have a job.
So as I mentioned, I think these are such early days. I've now spoken to my own team about a goal of $500 billion, which I think is very achievable. Not easy, mind you, but certainly achievable. And why am I so confident in that? I'm confident because we're growing in the number of countries that we're operating in. We're growing in terms of the number of firms that we're partnering with. And importantly, we're growing in terms of the relationship with current advisors, whether it's cross-selling or selling more of a current fund to more of their clients. And I see each of those three things happening simultaneously and with pretty great force.
And I was noting, as I thought about this, is that Morgan Stanley, when I was there, which admittedly was a long time, started with the individual component being 20% of its business, and today I think might be over 60. So it is interesting how these firms evolve. But just before we leave that point, of the geographies for which you are responsible, is there one that particularly excites you?
I'm often asked that, but we're so early in each of them that it would be like choosing among your children.
Well, we won't be doing that.
Yes. So the U.S. is the largest market. It's still early. So in pure dollars, that's likely to continue to be our biggest market. But the growth that we're seeing in Asia is quite strong. I would say Europe has a lot of potential that we haven't yet unlocked. So if I think about where investors are still mostly in daily liquidity or cash, it's Europe. So perhaps most optimistic longer term that that will provide a big market. But I would say we still have a long way to go.
And we might need some regulatory help on that front. But of course, with size comes complexity and challenges to culture. And you've been here for a long time. How has Blackstone dealt with enormous growth whilst retaining the culture that has clearly helped it prosper?
So it's interesting. I think that somehow, as we've grown, we've been able to knit the firm more closely together, but it's been deliberate. I will again go back to March of 2020 when we went virtual. That very first Monday, we launched a global meeting. It still happens every Monday where everyone can tune in and we talk about the macro environment, what's happening in the different businesses, what's happening geopolitically. We also have some fun in that meeting with photo contests and the like. Earlier on, we spent a lot of time around COVID support protocols, et cetera. It's a way to bring everyone in the firm together to start the week, just terrific. But then beyond that, we all, as leaders of our businesses, spend a lot of time around culture. I speak to it ad nauseum with my team. So one, of course, is modeling it. But when you talk about the importance of protecting the Blackstone brand and operating ethically, operating collaboratively, encouraging spirited debate, We talk about the need to pay close attention to detail, no matter what you're doing, the striving for excellence, et cetera. And then I also think it comes from top down. Steve Schwarzman, John Gray, spending time with each and every business when they can, traveling around the world to meet with all of the teams. I think there's an important element of creating that kind of culture that can only happen when you're together. And so a lot of time spent with employees is how you get there.
So the third of my trilogy was valuation. You've been at banks and a financial services analyst. A former colleague of yours and friend of the show, Peter Mayer, asked a very interesting question that I hadn't thought of, was, do you think the market understands Blackstone well enough? Particularly, does it give credit to the carried interest that sits within so many of the funds?
I would say to answer the latter, no, it does not, because the market prefers steady over lumpy. If you were to ask an investor, you're going to earn $100 two different ways. You'll earn it over the same period, but in one instance, it's going to be very steady, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, and another it moves around. The investor is much more comfortable with the 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, gives a much higher multiple to it. That's just the nature of it. You can say this is repeatable. But what's really changed about our business, particularly with the perpetual products, is that we are tilted much more towards management fees today than we were. And that has been a big catalyst in the expansion of our multiple.
So orthodox investment thinking was around countries and sectors. But I get a strong sense that thematic investing matters. And just explain how you achieve that in your investment process.
We are thematic investors. And when we find themes that we like, they tend to move across the entire firm. And some of them are big themes, obvious themes. So I'll take e-commerce. We all knew that the internet was disintermediating certain industries, perhaps retail being one of the more obvious. And that then informs not just what you're going to invest in, but what you're going to avoid. So that was the catalyst to buying up a lot of logistics assets, knowing that companies would need more first mile logistics. It also informed on the real estate side that we should avoid closed malls and single retailers who didn't have broad e-commerce distribution. It also gets you to think about payment processing, cybersecurity, and all of the industries that then cater to that. Second theme is the intersection of healthcare and technology. And that led us to build out a big life sciences business. It led us to invest in build-to-suit real estate for biopharmaceutical companies, and similarly to invest in technology companies that serve healthcare, that make processing, et cetera, more efficient and the like. The digitization of everything, whether it's online gambling or dating, digital content, how we access film, music, etc., gets you to think about what kind of investments you can make that both are direct and also catering. Online education is another one. We think about where there are structural shortages. I mentioned housing earlier. Energy is another area. Labor. And all of those themes, we do the research, it's shared across. So whether it's credit, private equity, real estate, growth equity, life sciences, we're able to benefit from that knowledge base.
Terrific. Thank you. Now I want to ask you a question that has been intriguing me. You wrote a Harvard Business Review entitled Truths for Our Daughter and co-authored Truth from My Daughter. Now, Will Campion, co-founder, and I each have two daughters. We're always keen to be better fathers. What can you tell us?
I'm not sure I can tell you how to be a better father, but as it relates to the truths, my daughter, who's now 27, at the time was in her first year of college, and she was studying to be a math major. She was applying for a leadership program. And after her second round of interviews, she called me in tears and said, "I've been invited for a final round and I'm not qualified." And that really made me sit back and think. One, I said to her, "You're a freshman in college. What exactly do you think you would be qualified for?" But I was trying to instill this sense of confidence and you can do it and you have the tools and everything else you can learn along the way. So it made me sit back and think about my own journey and if I knew then what I know now and life lessons. And so I wrote it. My daughter really liked it. And then Harvard published it on Mother's Day, appropriately.
Terrific. Okay, a few closing general questions is you've got a hell of a lot of responsibilities here. How do you relax?
Number of ways. I love running. So that's great in terms of just clearing my head. I love to read, listen to music, go to the movies. I love cooking. So just try to do the things that I like when I'm not at work.
And what's the one ambition yet to be fulfilled?
I'd love to get to the point in life where I feel like I'm doing enough in each part of my life, meaning I'm always thinking about what else could I be doing at work? What else could I be doing for family, philanthropically, for friends? And toggling between all of that. It would be great to get to the point where I feel like, oh, wow, I've now been able to give my all in each of those areas. I never feel quite that settled.
So my final question is, if you could wake up tomorrow having gained one quality that you don't currently have, what would that be?
Endless patience.
That makes two of us, and my children will testify to that. So, Joan, what a really super conversation. It's exciting to be here in New York. It's great to meet you. Everybody knows Blackstone and its extraordinary success. But I think what strikes me in concluding on a couple of thoughts is, number one, just how you have articulated that we're at the foothills of this secular shift to allocation to the alternatives, but that at the same time, walking hand in hand with that is the necessity for education as well as patience. And I think that this powerful trend and the message that we have been sharing on the Money Maze podcast and which you've articulated very well today will resonate and will be here for a long time. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.